We Love Movies with Gordon Hayden.
Now, playing in cinemas this weekend is Whitney. This is a new documentary all about the late Whitney Houston. What sets this one apart from Nick Broomfield's documentary Whitney, Can I Be Me, which is out on Netflix, is that the filmmaker Kevin MacDonald, who is highly acclaimed, he's an Oscar-winning filmmaker, he really digs deep and he uncovers parts of Whitney Houston's life that have never been made public before. And we're going to get into aspects of that in the interview you will hear very shortly on the show, and we'll be reviewing the film a little later on We Love Movies with Chris Wasser. But before I play that interview with Kevin MacDonald, who has helmed such documentaries as One Day in September, Touching the Void, he's also made feature films such as State of Play and The Last King of Scotland. It was great to be in his company, but first, here is a clip from Whitney.
There were times when I would look up to God and I'd go, why is this happening to me? I come from a family of singers.
My mom, she was a little tough on Whitney because she knew what Whitney had.
There were always a lot of secrets. When you don't resolve things and you don't deal with things, they never go away.
Tell me about Robin Crawford.
Robin was her safety net. Bobby was jealous.
His heart was, he wanted to be on the stage. He wanted to be in the forefront.
And eventually, she stepped down to lift him up.
I never knew there was any addiction.
Delighted now to be joined in studio by filmmaker Kevin MacDonald to talk about Whitney. Kevin, real pleasure to be in your company. Absolutely loved and adored the film.
Thanks very much.
I know we're sort of at the halfway mark of 2018, and you were looking at the best and worst films of the year. I have to say, for me, this is my favourite film of the year so far. Absolutely loved
it. That's a lovely, lovely thing to hear. Thanks very much. Nice to be here, especially after that introduction.
There we go. Listen, I hope it doesn't go south after that. But I just wanted to talk to you just before coming on board the project, because Whitney Houston, as a singer, as an artist, she doesn't strike me as someone that you would gravitate towards.
No, she's not. I mean, that's the thing, is that in a way, that's what made it such an interesting journey for me, that I started off a bit of a skeptic about her. You know, not, I suppose when I was growing up in the 80s, I was a teenager in the 80s, which is when she was at her height, she was not the one the cool kids were listening to, put it like that. But actually, I was persuaded that there was a fascinating story here. And I think the people who persuaded me were right. I think it is an amazing story. And it also takes you down all these different fascinating channels. And you learn a lot about, you know, the history of black music in America through the, you know, from the 60s onwards. But it's just also just a personal story about family and how families can mess you up, I suppose.
Very true, because there's some information that comes to the fore in this which hadn't been touched upon in other documentaries about Whitney Houston. That's why I implore people to go check this out. Would I also be right in saying that you played a bit of a detective in terms of digging deep into Whitney's story?
Yeah, I mean, I was lucky enough to have the cooperation of pretty much all her family and friends, her mother, her brothers, her sisters-in-law, all these people, all took part in the film. And in the end, all spoke very, very openly. But it took quite a long time to get there. And the first few times I interviewed them, because I ended up having to interview some of them 3-4 times maybe, which is really unusual when you're making a film. But the number of puff pieces I got from them was amazing. I'd never encountered anything like it. And I think the reason for that is because people felt guilty. They felt guilty for their part in her downfall, that they didn't do more, for instance. So you had to get past that to get to a place where people felt comfortable opening up. And in the end, they really, really did open up.
Well, were there people in her inner circle, like her agent, for example, Nicole David, who had said to you, I think at Sundance, that there was stuff even about Whitney that she was still unsure of, that wasn't clear, hence why she almost wanted you to go in a bit of Poirot mode and try to figure
stuff
out.
Yeah, that's what she
out.
Said. She said to me, this is Whitney's agent. She was a legendary agent in the 80s and 90s. She's the person who discovered Brad Pitt. She's a kind of huge person in Hollywood. And she said to me, Whitney was my favorite client I ever had. I loved her, but I never understood her. And I don't understand to this day why she went down the path she went down. And I really want someone to find out. I'd love you to be that person to find out. And it's that kind of really set me off on thinking, this is a mystery story. There is an enigma. Even the people closest to her don't fully understand her. So can I kind of crack that? And so I kind of try and take the audience on a bit of an investigative journey with me. So you meet people like Bobby Brown, who, you know, just gives you the denial, just doesn't want to say anything. And it's kind of, we're sparring a bit. And then you get other people who open up and are very emotional about it. So I hope that by the end of this detective story, people get to an answer that they feel, okay, now I kind of see the key. I understand her.
Because you mentioned key there, because when you hear about an actor taking on a role, and they kind of say, there's normally this one little facet of them that unlocks the character for them. When you're in that editing room and the amount of footage and audio that you would have gone through, talk about painstaking to say the least. And then you're adding other footage as well in to create a sense of the time, what was going on, especially within the black community. But what was it for you? What bit did you suddenly go, actually, I'm now really interested in Whitney Houston?
Funnily enough, the thing that, it sounds kind of banal, but the thing that really got me interested was that when she was a kid, I found out, she was really, really badly bullied because she was considered to be too light-skinned. She went to a school where there were lots of very dark-skinned kids. And her mother dressed her too prettily, and so she was sort of run home every day by the big kids who would threaten to beat her up. So she didn't have any friends. She hung out with her family, and her brothers were really her best friends. But then, later in her life, when she thought she was accepted and she'd become this big star, she went to the Black Music Awards called the Soul Train Awards, and she was booed. And there were people protesting outside the theater where the awards were, with signs saying "Down with Whitey Houston," and I think that really, really hurt her. So I was so fascinated by that kind of, like, to me she was a black singer, but to the African Americans she was somehow a sellout, and that was so. I think it was really, really, really hurtful to her.
Another thing which people will discover in the documentary, I don't want to give so much away, but there's one particular aspect which I just was blown away with in terms of how you managed to find out the information, was that she had been abused herself and her brother Gary. Yeah. And I know, Gary, you said, like, you had to interview these people a few times to break down that barrier.
Yeah.
How did you discover that? Because if that family is being very hesitant and putting these walls up, that couldn't have been difficult to just try and pinpoint them. There's something else has gone on in this family.
I just had a sense from watching all this footage of Whitney for months and months, sitting in a cutting room watching hours and hours of footage of her, that there was something odd about her. There was something that she felt a bit uncomfortable in her own skin, you know. And it reminded me of people I had met who had suffered childhood sexual abuse. There was something in her closeness, and so I started to ask around about that. And to begin with, the family were like, no, why are you asking that? And they got quite annoyed with me. But then finally the brother said to me, you know, I was abused, and that's why I'm an addict, he said, because I can't get these flashbacks out of my head of those times that I was abused. And then slowly other people opened up, and finally, this just 2 weeks before I finished editing the film, her longtime assistant said to me, actually, I want to go on the record about this. I want to talk to you about this. And so she said, look, I talked to Whitney a lot about this. And I think it was the only person who really, really talked to her about it. And I think it was the key to understanding her. It's why she couldn't quit the drugs. It's why she had this self-hatred about her. It's why maybe in a way she was confused about her gender identity. So it felt like the missing piece in a jigsaw puzzle for me making the film, and I wanted to reproduce that in the movie. You go on this detective story, and then you find this one piece of information quite towards the end, in the same way as I did making it.
Yeah, and they should say that the person behind that abuse actually turned out to be a female relative
who was a singer in her own right. Because Whitney's cousin was somebody called Dionne Warwick, who's like a legendary singer of the 60s and 70s, and huge hits. And she had a sister called Dee Dee. And Dee Dee was also a singer, but not as successful. In fact, she was quite embittered about the fact that she wasn't successful. And Dee Dee was the one who did the abuse.
The other thing I picked up with watching the documentary, Kevin, is that it seemed like Whitney was caught between two very narcissistic figures in her life. Her father, John, and we, of course, have Bobby Brown.
Yeah.
And for anyone that has any knowledge of narcissism, narcissists are someone who can be incredibly manipulative, and they can be overt and covert. And it just seemed like these men had a constant way of getting around her all the time. Is that a fair assumption of those people, do you think?
I think so. I mean, I'm not as condemning of them in a way. I mean, they've both done awful things, and they both definitely contributed to her destruction. I think Whitney, when you see her in the home video footage particularly, you see this really quite sweet, quite naive girl who actually, I think, never fully formed a character, never really fully formed a personality, a strong personality, and so she was easily manipulated by people. And I think the reason she never formed that strong personality is because of the abuse. And I think one of the things that often happens with people who suffers childhood abuse is that they kind of find themselves emotionally stuck at the time, I think, from when this happened. And that certainly was the case with her. I mean, it's one of the really touching things about the film, I think, is that you learn that Whitney was so unmaterialist. She didn't care about possession. She didn't care about money. She was earning hundreds and hundreds of millions of dollars, and it was all being stolen by her family and by her accountants. And in a funny way, it was being stolen because she didn't care. She didn't really care about it. She just wanted to be happily married. She wanted to have a kid. She wanted the simple things in life, but somehow that she didn't even manage to have. And that's what makes it so tragic, actually.
It is very, very sad. And like yourself, Kevin, I wouldn't have been a massive fan of hers. But when you see her story played out, especially in the manner and way which you've put it together, it is heartbreaking, especially when you can step back and go, oh, why weren't there people around her that could have looked after her? But she did. She had an incredible person in her life, her close friend and a one-time partner, Robin Crawford.
Yes.
She couldn't have asked for anyone better to kind of look out for her. But unfortunately, she kind of had an old self-destruct button in there as well.
Well, I think it was in those days it was much harder to be kind of sexually fluid, if you put it like that. You know, she had this relationship with Robin Crawford, which lasted for a few years, just around the time she was becoming successful. And then she had relationships with men, culminating in this guy, Bobby Brown. But I guess, you know, she had to hide that, the fact that she was bisexual or fluid. You know, today she wouldn't have been tortured by that. Also, partly growing up in the Baptist church in America, where they're very moralistic.
And her family would be quite homophobic as well, Kevin.
Yes, oh yes, you do. Oh yeah, you definitely get the sense of that. You know, and I think that comes from the religion. I think that's part of the kind of African-American cultural sort of landscape, that there is a lot of homophobia because they believe that's what's in the Bible, you know.
Kevin MacDonald, thank you so much for your time. Whitney, it's out in cinemas. Do check it out. It truly is unmissable.
That's brilliant. Thanks a lot.
We love movies with Gordon Hayden.
Now, out in cinemas this weekend is The First Purge. This is number 4 in the series, and of course, by the title, this is very much a prequel. I thought this series was dead and buried after the last film, but no, they're still going to try and find some mileage in it. Before we talk to Chris Wasser from The Herald about what he thought of this latest Purge flick, here's just a little bit from the trailer.
Tonight allows people a release for all the hatred and violence that they keep up inside them.
This won't bring him back. It won't make you feel any better. Thank you.
It is a night that is defining our country.
Citizens, this will be a tradition we celebrate every year. Join the First Purge.
Isaiah, come say bye.
Go do your thing, sis.
Always.
I'll see you tonight.
People are now calling this controversial experiment of legalized crime the Purge.
Do not purge!
Do not purge!
You and Isaiah, just stay with me during the Purge.
Oh, we're gonna be fine on our own.
We are here with Dr. May Updale. She came up with this experiment. Is the Purge a political device?
It is a psychological one. If we want to save our country, we must release all our anger in one night.
Tonight, we'll see the good and evil in everyone.
A bit there from the trailer to The First Purge, and joining me now is Chris Wasser to review the film. Chris, I will hold my hand up. The Purge movies, they haven't really been on my radar. So this one, you can go into it not knowing anything about the other films. But then again, Chris, I don't have much high hopes for this. So going into this film, Chris, straight away, what were your expectations?
Well, I actually have a confession to make of my own, which is that I haven't yet seen the first three Purge films, which I know is quite shocking. We were kind of expected to know exactly what's going on and supposed to have seen everything, but I must have been on holidays for those 3 weeks. But thankfully, as you mentioned there, The First Purge is a prequel. So for the uninitiated, for people coming in for the first time, you're going to get all caught up on the story. The creator and writer, this series started in 2013, and the creator and writer of the original three, who directed the first three films, but is not directing this one, James DeMonaco, his saga basically... If you've never seen it, it's set in an all too familiar America, and everything has gone just completely sideways. This new political party, they're a fascist regime known as the New Founding Fathers of America. They're in charge of things, and they have decided, in the other films, you know, we're getting the backstory here, but basically they've decided to introduce, to make everything better, to revive law and order and society and to revive the American dream. They decide that for one night a year, all crime is legal. We're talking about everything here. Get everything off your chest, vent, go mad. People are allowed to murder people. You're allowed to do whatever you want so long as everyone behaves themselves for the rest of the year. And this No Rules Night is known as the Purge. And the first film was one of the most successful low-budget horror films in recent years. I think it was made for something like $3 million, and it grossed close to $100 million. And it starred Ethan Hawke. It was more of a home invasion thriller, or so I've heard. He's not in the other few, and I think we're pretty much all caught up. So this film is an attempt to kind of breathe new life into the series and show you how this purge began, how, you know, we got to the events in the first film.
Now, you mentioned, Chris, that the original writer-director, James DeMonaco, he is not part of this at all. We've got a fresh face in there, Gerard McMurray.
Yes.
What is he like as a director? Because for people who have been fans of the Purge movies to date, the first two... No, they rattle along. One friend of mine liked them because he said they're almost like entry-level John Carpenter films. I think that might be damning them with faint praise. But with a new guy at the helm, now granted, Chris, obviously you haven't seen the other films, but what did you make of McMurray's direction here? Like, is he a fella you go, oh, he shows a bit of promise?
No, not a whole lot. I mean, there are times during this film where I thought, am I watching a music video here? It was surprisingly shoddy. And it has a lot going for it in terms of, you know, it picks and chooses what genre it would like this film to fit in. So it's a horror 1 minute, then it's a thriller, it's a drama, a social commentary, it's an action film. But Gerard McMurray doesn't really show much of a flair for any of those genres. I mean, as a horror, it's not particularly frightening. If you watch the news, it's actually scarier because, you know, these films are quite timely. They do sometimes have a lot to say about, you know, real world anxieties and fears and prejudices in modern America. But it goes about saying things about the current state of America in a very sloppy and often stupid way. And then also as an actioner, Jeremy Murray doesn't really show any signs that he knows how to piece together a coherent or action set piece. So it is quite sloppy at times, which is a shame because there could be a decent story in there. James DeMonaco is, you know, writing this screenplay, and, you know, it's all quite complicated, but the basic gist is that the first purge was something of a societal experiment by the NFFA, and they decided to experiment on the poor people of Staten Island. So, you know, they were focusing on low-income areas, and people on the breadline are asked to participate in this first purge, you know, to either stay at home or to actually go out and kill people, and they're offered monetary rewards. And we kind of focus on Naya, played by Lex Scott Davis, who, you know, protests the purge with all her might. And then you've got her little brother, Isaiah, and you've also got a local drug kingpin who might redeem himself. His name is Dimitri, played by Yolande Knoll. All newcomers here. And you're focusing on their lives, you know, their story for this 12 hours of just mayhem in Staten Island. And Marissa Tomei is in there, oddly, as the scientist who started this all. And I don't know why she was cast in this. I don't know why she did it, because she spends half the time looking just mortified to be saying the things that she's saying and to be playing this half-drawn character. And that's the thing. They are all sketches. They're not real characters. So there's some interesting ideas here, but it's when it gets down to, you know, once that alarm bell rings, once the purge alarm sounds, it just goes bananas, and not in a very clever way. As I said, in quite a sloppy and occasionally a very shoddy way.
Oh, that's so disappointing to hear, because the first Purge films, even though that, even like some hard and horror fans would go, yeah, there's a great concept there, but it just didn't really get it the way it should have. Like, I think it's a better idea at play. But one thing that those previous films had was they had charismatic leading men in Ethan Hawke and Frank Grillo. Marissa Tomei sounds like she's here for the paycheck, Chris.
Yeah.
And what about the other cast? Are they just sort of like phoning it in here, or are they just sort of fresh faces but don't offer much?
No, I think that, you know, Yulan Knoll, like Scott Davis, Wyvern Wade, they are talented young actors and they do the best, you know, with the material that they're given. Unfortunately, they're given some very on-the-nose, heavy-handed, dour and depressing one-liners. And they're there, you know, especially the guy who plays Dimitri, the drug lord, Yulan Knoll. He has as much fun as he can because towards the end, he starts to turn into this kind of action man seeking redemption, you know, without spoiling things there. But they're just wasted, again, because the characters are not very well drawn out. And it's quite a shame because, as I keep saying, this film does come with a promising premise. It does come with a clever setup. And it's not altogether out of sync with, you know, real world troubles at the moment. And I mean, it's not, it is a bonkers premise, but there are moments in the film where you're thinking that's not as far fetched as we would, you know, as we'd like it to be.
Yes.
But it's just not very effective in its delivery. And it almost goes out of its way sometimes to be spectacularly stupid. And the thing that bothered me was that, as far as the social commentary side is concerned, it seems that the only way this film knows how to tackle the subject of racial and societal tensions in America is by having everyone shoot at each other. So it just resorts to this mind-numbing bloodbath where everyone's literally just shooting at each other. And it's just, after, you know, 10 minutes of that, it just gets nasty. So it doesn't leave the mark that I think it would like to leave. And it isn't nearly as clever as James DeMonaco would have you believe.
All right then, Chris, out of 10 for The First Purge.
It's just all over the shop, Gordon. And I don't think, you know, just on the basis of this, I doubt I will be, you know, giving the other three films a try. So it's 2 out of 10.
Oh God, that good, that good. Oh, listen, I wouldn't put you through the pain of watching those other ones if that one's 2 out of 10 there from Chris Wasser.
We Love Movies with Gordon Hayden.
And that is it for part one of We Love Movies, but Chris will be back in part two as the pair of us will be taking a look at the new biopic Whitney. We had the film's director on the show a little earlier, Kevin MacDonald. It's one of those documentaries there's so much to talk about. Plus, Andy McCarroll will be going through the films that inspired Dublin Old School. We Love Movies is back shortly.